nice flavored coffee. I don't want to seem ungrateful, but it's flavored coffee. Anyway, it's good to be here. Thank you for asking me to come out. I don't get out on Tuesday night, so it's a rarity I can come out. And I'm an alcoholic. My name is Brian, and I really don't know what I'm going to say, but I'll start off with this. And my sobriety date is March 6th of 1993. The only interesting thing about that is I didn't get up that day to get sober. I was on a 3-month relapse after being sober for a year. And it was like any other day. I was going to go to the dog track and then go smoke crack and drink all night. Somehow I got 12-step back in AA and I haven't had a drink since. Or any other mind-altering substance. And I find that amazing. I find that really amazing because I'm a guy who could not drink or could not not drink in any situation, in any institution, in any surrounding. I'm a guy who drank in prison, I drank in the youth center, I drank in rehabs, I drank in halfway houses. Wherever they put me, I would find a way to drink or I would drink. And I haven't had a drink in almost 15 and a half years, so I'm still baffled by that. It is good to be sober, it's good to be here. My home group is the It's in the Book Big Book Meeting in Camden, Maine. Though I do not live in Camden, Maine, I live in Union, Maine. You know where that's at, it's in the middle of nowhere. And I grew up on the West Coast. And I'm going to share with you, the big book is really interesting, it really tells you what to do. You know, I'll share what I was like, what happened to me, and what I'm like now. And I'm a guy, when I first got sober, and I come out of the big book, and I got sober out of the big book, I got really directed with some good directions. And I used to speak and I used to say things like, I would only talk about recovery. I wouldn't talk about where I would come from. I think I did a big disservice to people because most people need to know that I'm a real alcoholic. They need to know I'm a real alcoholic. I grew up in California. Grew up in this town called Stockton, California. I'm not going to take you all the way back to my childhood, so don't worry. I'm not going to do this for 3 hours or so. But I did grow up in California, and I come from a family of... I'm the youngest of four boys, and I come from a criminal background, if that's anything interesting to anybody. But it's the mindset of the environment I grew up in. And I was the youngest of the four, and my brother died when he was... 7, I was 5, and so it was pretty much my 2 older brothers and me. And I was surrounded with a lot of alcohol. My mom was a barroom drunk, and I remember there was things I used to say about my mom, because I was a latchkey kid, which you don't hear that very often anymore, but basically that means my parents worked, and so when I came home from school, it was just me and my older brothers and the neighborhood kids. And my mom used to come home, and the only reason I'm saying this, this isn't about my mom, trust me, but it's more about my mindset and the resolve I had to not become like her and how I went 10 times worse than her. But my mom used to come home from work, and she would slop us some food together if she did that, and then she would bolt out the door to the bar room. And I used to sit around. I was torn. Half of me liked it because then I could run the streets and do whatever I wanted. The other half was mad because she would do that. And my dad would then go off to the bar and try to drag her home, and it'd be a big battle, or he would stay there with her all night. And sometimes she wouldn't come home until 3 and 4 in the morning, and sometimes she wouldn't come home the next day. And I had a huge resentment against my mom growing up about, because I thought alcoholism, I didn't even consider alcoholism, I just think she was making bad choices, you know, like she's just a bad mother because she would drink. And I remember thinking, I'll never get like her, you know. And when I was 10, 11 years old, I started smoking a lot of outside issues, and then I started drinking a lot of booze, and I wasn't a daily drinker, you know, I was just a guy who would steal booze from my mom's cabinet, or they'd have parties at the house, and I would just get drunk, and nobody would ever say anything. And alcohol for me, and this was to be repeated all the way up to the age of 30 where I got sober, alcohol changed me. It changed everything about me. It changed how I felt about myself, it changed how I felt about you, it changed how I felt about the life, the world, everybody. It just totally transformed me and made everything okay. But I would have never have put that. I just like to drink. I mean, I would have never have put those words together. Alcohol for me, I just like to drink. I like to go out and hang out with the guys while my mom and dad are out partying. And we would often go out to the fields and we would just drink and get drunk and then throw rocks through windows and do kid stuff, you know. There was not a lot of problems with my drinking. My mom, basically, her mantra was, when I was growing up in high school, it was like, so what are you doing tonight? I said, oh, I'm going to a party. I'm going to a keg party. Oh, they're going to be booze. I said, yeah, hence the keg, Mom. That's the whole point of that. And she would say, well, if you get drunk, just sleep in your car. And so when you're a 16-year-old kid, 17-year-old kid, you got the green light to just get trashed and then sleep in the car. That's what I would do. And the only thing significant about my drinking as I started to grow up is it started to get where I would drink on the weekends and I would have fun, you know, like a football game. We'd go out to these big keg parties out in the desert. This is in Tucson, Arizona. I'm jumping all over the place, so just bear with me. And the only thing that I could see that I could identify that maybe I had a problem with booze was I would never leave. If there was a keg party going on, I would never leave about a 15-foot circle of the keg. Like, I wouldn't go without eyesight of the keg. You know, even if I had to go to the bathroom, you know, we'd just turn around and go. And I would never leave the party while there was still booze there. I was never one of those guys who would say, hey, we'll see you later, I gotta go to work tomorrow, or, you know, like guys would leave at 11, 12 o'clock at night, and I was always baffled by that. I'm like, why would you want to go? You know, like, there's still booze here, we still got stuff happening. And then I would drink till it was empty, and then I would crawl in my car, and then wake up at 6 the next morning and drive home. And I didn't think that was a problem. In fact, I thought that was kind of cool. I thought that was all right, you know. Everything between 10 and 18 was kind of one of those, you know, I went to the youth center, ran away from home, stole a boat, got arrested, did some B&Es, minor stuff, you know, stuff that, you know, lots of kids probably weren't doing, but I did. And nothing was really, like, you could have never have convinced me at the age of 18 that I was alcoholic. Never would have done it. You know, I was having fun. You know, I graduated in 1980, so you know I'm 46 years old, which is another thing that confuses me. That I'm actually, I still think I'm like in my 20s. I don't know what's up with that. But I'm 46, and my wife would say 46 and a half, but I'm 46. And so when I graduated in 1980, and this is when, and my drinking was getting, it was getting progressively worse. You know, it was getting to where I would want to drink. It was getting where sometimes when I would, I used to always pride myself on having a job, right? I got a job. You know, and my whole purpose for having a job was twofold. One is it's a good place to steal money. I never worked at any job that I had to steal anything from. So it kept me in weed and it kept me in drinking money. And two, I always worked in restaurants where we could steal booze. So that was kind of my thing. I didn't put gas in my car. It wasn't like I wanted to further my career washing dishes at the, Tankerverde Guest Ranch is where I worked a lot at. It was like an old dude ranch out in Tucson. And I stole a lot of booze from that place. And, stole a lot of steaks and had a lot of fun. And I started to do things like started to drink, you know, 17, 18 years old, started drinking on the job. Not even thinking that's a problem. Thinking that everybody does that. But I couldn't identify any of that. You know, in fact, even when I got sober in 93, when I started to go through the steps, I'd been in AA for a year before that. But when I got sober then, I remember a guy taking me through the steps and he started to explain alcoholism. I was in AA for a year and did not know what an alcoholic was. But I said I was alcoholic. And you know, you guys didn't do it here, but in Tucson, and I know lots of meetings where everybody goes around the room and says they're alcoholic. I said that for a year, never believed it once. And the only reason I did it was because every other duck was quacking in the room, and so when it came to me, I quacked like everybody else. But the truth is, in my heart of hearts, I didn't believe I was alcoholic, you know? It was baffling to me when I started to understand that, you know, I got a problem with alcohol. And I didn't learn that until I was 30. And so when I graduated in 1980, I made this decision. I had lots of times in my life where I could have gone left or right, and I always went right, and it was always wrong. But I always went right, thinking that was the right way to go. And I made a decision, they're saying, well, you should go to college, and you know, if you're me, and I came from a school, and this is in Tucson, Arizona, that had 2,000 students. It was a big school. There was over 500 students in my graduating class, and I was about 470 down the line. You know, like I was on the back end. I was barely graduating. I get kicked out all the time. And so when they said you should go to college, it was like, yeah, that's not an option for me. And so a lot of my friends went this way, and a lot of my, most of them were my pot smoking buddies and my drinking buddies. We kind of went this way, and we all got four of us moved into a house together. In 1980, I'll never forget, the June of 1980, I graduated June, and about 2 weeks after graduation, I moved out of my parents' house, and I started painting houses, and doing what guys do, you know, you work. this is, we're working. You know, I'm working 8 hours a day. We're all working construction. They're like masons and painters and carpenters. And we're, you know, we work all day. We come home and we all come home with booze. We start drinking and then we go off to the bar and we go play pool or we have a party at our house. And it's not a lot of problems. It's not a big problem. You know, nobody I knew was going to rehab in 1980, 1981. No one I hung out with, you know. People would not come around anymore. That was kind of weird. People would, all of a sudden I'd stop seeing people, and we wonder what happened. We didn't know they were going to rehab. So, I just was never spoken. AA, I never heard of AA until I went to prison. And that was only because they announced it over the PA system. It wasn't because I went into the AA meeting, it was just because they announced it. And then I'd look at all the people going to the AA meeting and judge them. So what happened for me, and drugs are part of my story, this is an AA meeting, I'm going to be real respectful of the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I cannot tell my story without telling what happened, because in 1980, 1981, though I was become a daily drinker, and it was not like I woke up in the morning and drank, I used to say, well, I don't drink in the morning, but I get up in the morning and I get baked, you know what I mean, I'm like getting the bong out, and I'm getting baked before I, you know, before I eat anything, before I do anything, I'm getting slanted eyed, you know, and then I go to work. And then I work all day, and then at lunchtime I get baked again. And then around 3 or 4 I start drinking. And so my measuring stick was, I don't drink in the morning. And we had a few friends who were drinking in the morning, like, man, that's messed up. If I start drinking in the morning, I got problems if you're drinking in the morning. But I would start thinking about drinking around lunchtime. And I would be thinking about where I'm going to go that night, what I'm going to do. And in Tucson, it's really cool. They have drive-thru liquor stores, which I think is really impressive. And so I would come off the job site and then I'd go to the drive-thru liquor store and I'd get a 12-pack of Budweiser and 2 16-ounces in a bag. And then that would be the 2 16 for the ride home. And then I'd start drinking. But once I got 3 or 4 into my 12-pack or whatever I was buying that night, depending on my finances, I would immediately start counting. I was the type of guy who I would see how many people were in the house, who was over that night, how much booze was around, and I would already calculate whether we're going to have enough or not. And then I would either bolt, go to a liquor store, and then stash it, or I would go to a club and drink, you know, whatever. I would just go somewhere and drink where I could get my fill. I knew once I started drinking, I was not a guy who was drinking 3 or 4 beers and then going to bed. That's just not who I am. You know, I'm drinking till I pass out. That's the story of my life. But I'm not an alcoholic. I just like to have fun. You know, I mean, that's just having fun. That's what you do. And I started to get involved in this, Tucson was what they call Cocaine Alley. It was like 30 miles from Mexico. I forget the interstate, but it was, they called it Cocaine Alley because they brought all this stuff up through and it was really cheap. And I went to the dog track one night and I'd been dabbling in that substance, you know, what we call an outside issue in AA. But I went to the dog track one night and I won a lot of money, me and my buddy. And we went to this guy's house. And instead of snorting it, this outside issue, we started to smoke it. And now this is pre-crack for all you guys. And you have to label that because this is back in 1981, 82. And I got involved in that in a really deep way. And now I understand, I have by nature a mind that always looks for shortcuts and always tries to get, you know, the easy way out. And I'm also a guy who... For lack of a better word, I have a criminal mind. And so I'm always looking for the edge. And what I realized is the habit I was getting was I couldn't support that of my own financial nature. When you're making $7 an hour painting houses and you're starting to smoke what I was smoking, you couldn't do it. So I started to deal drugs. And the thing with me is I love booze. I love the feeling of booze. But also, you know, when you start to get around 11, 12 o'clock and you're drinking a lot, you start to get a little tired. So I love this other stuff that would just actually catapult me to the rest of the day, rest of the evening. But then I realized I can't make enough money. You know, I couldn't handle this, so I started dealing drugs. And I'm a guy, this is, if you're a drug dealer, you'll know what this means. If you're dealing the substance you're smoking, it's a problem. Okay? And if you're good like I am, which is, you know, I don't have a lot of money to go get, so I would go get these ounces from these guys. I'd say, hey, can you give me an ounce? And they'd give me an ounce, and I'll get you back in a week. You know, if you give me an ounce. They trusted me. I'm a nice guy. Look at me. Come on. You would give me your wallet in a heartbeat. And then I would start to sling little nickel and dime, you know, quarter grams, half grams. And then I'd come back with about $1,500, $500 short, and I would say, hey, look, here's this. I got the other $500 fronted, and I'm going to get that to you next week, and I can't get another one. And then I started piling this up, and then after about 6 months to about a year of this, I started going to other dealers, and then pretty soon, after about a year and a half, my name starts getting slammed all over town. And I'm, you know, now I'm getting to a place where people actually want their money back. Which, you know, I understand that, but I thought they were being inconsiderate because, you know, this is a business venture. Just have a little patience, please. And the whole time, I'm a guy, I'm living such a double life. Nobody knows what's going on. Nobody knows. My fiance doesn't know. My roommates don't know. Nobody knows how deep I'm getting. Nobody. And I was 21, and I was in a place, and I'm not a guy who, I've never been, I know some people are like this, really depressed. They get, you know, I'm not a guy who would go into deep depression. I mean, I used to listen to the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, and then, you know, with all the lights off and think about my funeral, but I wasn't really a depressed kind of guy. I was like a fake. And I was sitting around one night with this guy named Dave Kerr, and him and I were like running partners. He was my road dog. We ran together, we worked together, we drank together, we smoked together, and we were just, everybody was out partying, and I didn't have anything. I didn't have anything. I had no money. Everybody was out the club. I couldn't get any of this outside issue that I like to smoke, and I couldn't get anything, and I couldn't get any booze. And we're sitting around, and he's like, hey, this sucks. And I go, yeah, man, this really sucks. And so I came up with a plan, and the plan for me, and Dave was the type of guy, Dave wasn't a leader, I was the leader, which is always weird, because I'm like 5'1", I shouldn't be leading anything. And I get really stupid thoughts. Like, so my thought this night was, hey, we could go rob the Kentucky Fried Chicken. That was the plan. You know? And he's like, Dave never committed a crime in his life. I mean, I've been to the youth center. I've done stuff. But he had never even thought about that. And I said, look, I got some pistols, and I got ski masks, and some rope. We go down to Kentucky Fried Chicken. Tie these guys up. Boom, bang. We'll take the safe. We're good to go. And I go, I've been there late at night. There's like a weak crew. It's like 3 people, 2 girls, and some goofy guy. We can do this. It was Back in Black, AC/DC had just come out, you know, so we were jamming over there. We were like, and I used to have long hair and wear these big bandanas, you know, and this pretty awesome roach, you know. And I was like, we were jamming, you know, like, and we're like, yeah, we're doing this, we're taking this down. We went in there, we didn't do it, we ended up buying a Cooper's meal. And Dave was one of those guys. Dave was a bummer. You know, he used to bum me out all the time. I said, dude, you're bumming me out, man. Like, because he was one of those guys who would go into depression. And anyway, I dropped him off. And I said, I'll see you tomorrow. You know, I usually picked him up for work. But I didn't go home. You know, I went home. You know what I did? I drove home. And I got a piece of hose. And I cut off a piece of hose. I got a roll of duct tape. And I threw it in my roommate's car. Because that's what I was going to rob this place with. And I drove out to the desert. And the thought of suicide had never come in my mind. I had never even thought about that. It wasn't a fad like it is now with people doing it. I never thought about it. I didn't know anybody. Never really even talked about it. But that night, I was so hopeless. And I was so desperate. And I was so, like, just empty and dead inside that I was going to check out. And it was not one of those, cut my wrist, run in my roommate's room and say, look, I'm, you know, take me out. It wasn't none of that. It was like, I'm driving out of the desert. And I'm out in the middle of nowhere, and I get out of the car, and I put the hose in, I tape it up, and I get in the car, and I start pumping fumes. And I just don't see any hope. See, this is 21 years of age. 21 I was at. That's why when guys come in at 18, 17, 16, I don't even question it. You know what? Because at 21, I was so hopeless, you know. And if somebody would have told me, oh, you know, just suck up, that wasn't a, you know, I was dead inside at 21. And I didn't get sober 9 years later. And I started to pump the fumes, and I got really close to dying that night. I got really groggy, and I started to get nauseous, and I started to nod out, and I was writing letters. And this is the type of son I was, so you understand how big this moment was. I was the type of son that when my mom and dad questioned my drinking a couple years earlier, 3 years earlier, they'd said, me and your dad want to talk to you, and they said, you know, we're concerned about your drinking. Well, I should have stopped going to my parents' house. That was my solution. Like, okay, I'll check into that. And then I just wouldn't go home. You know, I lived a mile from my mom, and I hadn't seen her except on Christmas, Thanksgiving, and my birthday, maybe her birthday. And 4 times, 5 times a year, I'd go see my mom. I lived a mile from her. Right? That's the type of son I was, right? And so here I am writing this letter, and I was writing this letter to my mom, and I don't know, you know, this is definitely a God thing for me, because at that moment, at that time, I had this overwhelming thought of how much that would destroy my mom, because she had already buried one of her boys. And I don't know why that selfless thought came into my heart that at that moment, I can't do that to my mom. It wasn't like I had any more hope. It wasn't like I had a plan. It wasn't like things will get okay. I still think it was going to be crappy. But at that moment, I thought, man, I can't do that to my mom. I love my mom too much to have her bury another boy. And so I drove, you know, I just climbed out of the car and I walked around the desert and I came up with another plan. This is my second big plan in one night, so you know I was on a roll. And I didn't plan this out, but I drove into town the next morning and I robbed the bank. You know, and it was about that casual. I walked in, stood in line. In fact, if I had to reinvent that whole scenario, I could still remember the lady looking at me like, what are you, crazy? I went to, you know, you fill out your forms, you know, you fill out your deposit slips, and I basically wrote on the back of it, I didn't know I was writing this, but I wrote, I have a gun, this is a bank robbery, I will kill you, give me $50. That's what I wrote. And I stood in line, because I think that's the proper thing to do if you're going to rob a bank. So I stood in line, and when it was my turn, I called up and I slipped the lady the note, and she looked like this, down at me. That's what it felt like, she was looking down at me. And I looked up at her and said, yeah, I'm serious, and she slid me a $50 bill. And I took it and ran. So you know you're not dealing with a criminal here. I'm not really a gangster. I'm just, I was a snot-nosed punk. I weighed about 105 pounds, and I was just way out of control. And I remember, the only thing I remember that is I think I was in a sober blackout, because I wasn't sober at the time. I ran to my car, which I parked a couple blocks away, and I drove about 3 miles to a 7-Eleven, and I was shaking so bad, it was like shaking, and I went in and bought a 12-pack of Budweiser, and I got about 4 beers down, and as soon as I was done with that fourth one, it felt like everything was like, booze worked for me every time. It was like, all right, dude, that was crazy. You know, like, you just robbed the thing. And you only got $50, man, that's not even worth it. So I drove across town and robbed another bank about an hour later. And I got $50. I know people always say, what did you get? None of your business, but I didn't get $50. I know that. And then I came home. I paid all my debts off. I went to every drug dealer I owed money to, paid everybody off. I re-upped, right, a couple times, and I paid my rent. I paid every bill. I paid everything off, and I had a pocket full of money and a bag full of coke and some booze in a bag. And my girlfriend says, God love her, she says, how was work? And I'm a painter, right? And anyone painted for a living knows that you come home with paint on you. I came home the last year that I lived with that woman covered in paint, and I was clean as can be. And I said, work was great. Let's go out to dinner. We'll go shopping. And that's what we did. You know, we went out and I started spending money like I was a drunk sailor. And about 6 months later, I remember I had a boss that was, you know, he was like I was. And I said, hey, I need the keys to the van. Man, I got to go make some errands. He said, yeah, give me the keys to the van. I drive into town, rob a bank, go back to the job site. And I'm thinking, seriously thinking, why is everybody doing this? You know, like, what are they doing? Why don't you just ask for it, man? They just give it to you. And what I did understand, but here's what happened. 2 weeks later, about a week later, I came home from work. This is just to give you the definition of the guys I run with. I came home from work. It was like every other night I had some booze. And I went to put it in the refrigerator. And I look on the refrigerator and there's a picture of me that was cut out of the paper. One of my roommates had saw it. They cut it out of the paper and put it on that thing. And it didn't say my name. It was just like me coming out of a bank waving, you know, like, hey. And underneath it said, $5,000 reward. Call 88 Crime. That's when 88 Crime started hitting the road, you know, and everybody's like, so I'm like, immediately my knees start buckling. I'm like, man, that looks just like me. I didn't even have that shirt in my room right now. And I'm like, man, right? Like, get my stuff together, and I rip it down, and I go out. My roommates are all out there, and they're all baked because they've been home like an hour. And I throw it on the table. And I'm like, dude, what's that? And they go, man, it's crazy, Brian. Some dude looks just like you running around town on the bank. And I'm thinking, as soon as they said that, it's like, I thought, cool. if they don't know, then nobody knows. Hmm. And then about a week later, I got arrested. The FBI came in. and they arrested me. You know, somebody obviously, you know, needed a new car or something. But they arrested me. And then the only thing that seemed to make it is my parents did what parents do. My parents loved me so much. Is he bailed me out 3 days there, and he got me a lawyer, and then the lawyer told me the truth, which nobody had really told me the truth, which is, Brian, you're going to go to prison. You can't rob 3 banks and not go to prison. And I said, well, what does that mean? They're like, well, you, a year, 2 years? He said, no, probably 5 or 10 years. Now, when you're 21 and you're talking 10 years, that's like a, that's, 30 is like so old, right? I mean, I remember that. 30 is like ancient. I got a 17-year-old daughter. She's a foster daughter, but she's my dog as far as I'm concerned. I know she's like thinking, I'm ancient, you know what I mean? I get that thought process. And I thought, my life is over. It is over. And so I started drinking really, really bad. I started waking up drinking. And once I start drinking, because I have this physical allergy to alcohol, once I put alcohol into my system, it's not like I just drink a few and then call it good. I drink all day. And I do other things all day so I don't fall asleep. Or if I do pass out, I wake up and I start drinking more. And it was bad for about 2-3 months. It was really bad. I was really bummed out and I knew, what's the use? And one day, everybody's like, hey, we're going to the bar. You know, they're all happy to go to the bar. I don't have any money because nobody's hiring me, right? Because I'm going to prison soon. And nobody's giving me any drugs for free anymore, you know, because I'm hot as heck. You know, nobody wants me even around. And understandable, right? And I'm sitting there thinking, man, this is suck. And I look at my roommate and I said, hey, can I borrow your car? I need to go cash a check. Which, hey, this is, I don't want to take his inventory or anything, but come on. Dude, I haven't worked in a long time. I don't have no check to cash. But he gives me his keys to his car. And I drive. It's a Friday afternoon. And I go rob a bank on a Friday afternoon. And I knew I was going to get pinched. I knew it. And I didn't care. It's like, so what? I'm getting some money tonight and I am drinking and partying this weekend. And that's what I did. I drank and partied that weekend. And I knew the FBI was coming after me Monday or Tuesday. I just said, well, whatever. And they came and got me on Monday. And I didn't see the streets for the next 6 years. And thank God they saved my life. You know, there's a running joke. Guys who do time will know this. You know, it's like, we used to always say, yeah, you weren't arrested. You were saved, you know. And the truth was, I was saved. I was a train wreck waiting to happen. You know, and it wasn't going to be my life. It was going to be somebody else's, you know. And that's the way it was going to go down. And I just didn't see the severity of it. I just didn't get it. I was so immersed in my alcoholism. And so 6 years, you know, I got a 6-year sentence. We make a lot of run right to the solution now. I did 5 years, 8 months on that bid. Got out. Didn't think I was going to drink. Thought I was just do my time. And I was old law fed. And I would just get off. But I can't, you know, I can't. That, they can give me all the conditions. In fact, my professor was real clear. It's not like he tricked me. He gave me all the things I needed to stay on the streets. He said, you can't drink alcohol. You can't use drugs. You got to be here when you're there. He gave me all the rules and laid them all out. But as soon as I'm on the streets, you know, as soon as I'm out there, I think I stayed sober maybe a month. You know, I drank one time and I said, okay, I got to do that. I got to control myself. And then it's never been the first drink that's always got me drunk. I used to love that in AA. That's a great line, right? It's the first drink that gets you drunk. They say it in AA a lot. And I think it's a cute saying, but I think they're missing the point because it's never been the first drink that's gotten me drunk. It's been the unprotected thought that precedes the first drink. See, that's the deal for me. Like, I have a type of mind, when I shouldn't drink, I will go to prison if I drink. There's no reason to drink. I'm okay. But I'm not okay. And the thought pops up into my head, and I don't even think about it. I don't think about the consequences. I don't think about how I'm going to get beat the system. I just say, screw it, and I drink. I end up in liquor stores. I end up at bars drinking. I don't even know how I got there. And I got no protection against the first drink. I don't care what conditions you put on me. I don't care what's on at stake. Girlfriend, freedom, family, job, it doesn't mean anything, man. If I don't have any protection against that first drink, I will drink. Okay, that's just the way it is. And so I started drinking. I got no protection. I got no recovery. I'm not doing AA. I'm supposed to go to AA, but I'm signing the name. I learned the system a long time ago. I went to one AA meeting and I asked, well, who needs to sign my list? Like, I thought the president of AA was going to sign my list, right? Nobody's in charge in AA. Some goofball with no teeth signs my list. So I'm thinking, come on, this guy can't even write his name. If that's their check system here, I got that. So I started writing meetings down, And then, about 4 or 5 months later, my professor calls me and he said, I'm looking at your AA list and I see on Wednesdays you go to this. And I'm pulling my list out on the phone like, yeah, that's the meeting I go to. He says, yeah, when's the last time you were there? I was there last Wednesday. He said, well, that's weird. That meeting's been closed for 6 months. he says, and also you tested positive for, we have 3 dirty urns. And I said, this is what I say. I say, yeah, what does that mean? I got no one to meet. And he says, why don't you come down and see me? And I'm like, Tim, that's probably not going to happen. Just want to let you know that right now. I'll see you later. And I hung up. I was living with my parents. Walked into my bedroom, grabbed all my stuff, threw it in my car, and my mom says, where are you going? And I go, I'm moving. I don't tell her where I'm moving. I don't say anything, right? I'm moving. And I moved out that night, and I lasted another 4 or 5 months on the streets before the marshals arrested me. And if I had more time, I'd tell that colorful story, because that was a nightmare. But the truth is, I'm a wreck. You know, I'm an alcoholic. I'm a real alcoholic, man. I just can't not drink. You know, I just have to drink, man. And with that goes everything else. And so I end up going back for a year on a violation. And now I got seven years in almost. And I get out. And the only thing different, getting out at the time, the only thing different was that I don't want to drink now. I'm really starting to think I shouldn't drink. I think that I'll just go to this halfway house. And I went to this place called New Beginnings Treatment Center, which is kind of like this place probably is a halfway house for guys coming out of prison. The transition back in, and the first day that I'm allowed to go out free, and I have like $50 to my name, and that's all I got. I'm 29 years old, and I'm broke, and I'm homeless, and that's all I got. And in my mind, as soon as I step out the gate and hit the street and start walking, this thought pops into my head. It's like, man, you should have a drink. And I go drink that day. And then I get caught 3 days later, and I get sent to AA. This is real. And I don't know why my parole officer sent me to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't really care. I just know that for some reason, he thought that he would give me a break. And so I went to AA. And I lasted a year in AA. And here's what happened in AA for me. First off, I really started seeing, man, I got a problem. Like, this is a problem. I'm about ready to go back to the penitentiary one more time. Like, that's something wrong with that picture. And I'm willing to give up my freedom. And I started thinking, you know, I'm 29 years old, and my picture of an alcoholic is a guy living on Skid Row. I don't fit that picture. So here's how ignorant I am. A week, you know, like not even a week into sobriety, I'm selling blood on the streets. That's how poor I am. That's where I am at. I have absolutely no money. They gave me one break. I gotta go get a job. I have no money to get a bus pass. And so I'm out selling plasma because new donors get $25. And I remember standing in line. I was on 4th Avenue, downtown Tucson, and I'm waiting in line with everybody else. And you had to tip the scale. I think it had to be 110. And I remember wearing 3 layers of clothes so I could tip the scale. Okay? That's how pathetic I am. And I remember looking around all the other losers that were in line with me, thinking, what a bunch of losers. You know? Like, I'm a player, you know? Don't you know that I was the shortest bank robber in captivity from 1984? That means anything, right? No. That was my claim to fame. Shortest bank robber in captivity for 7 years. Big deal, right? And I go to AA and I start hanging out in AA. And the one thing I there's a few things I liked about AA and there's a few things I didn't like. I'll tell you what I didn't like. I didn't like that they were way too friendly and they looked you in the eye. I didn't like that. I was a shoe watcher. I strictly came in, looked around, you know, basically found chairs by looking at the floor. If there's no shoe there, I'll sit down in it. Could not look you in the eye because I know you would know who I really was. I didn't like that they were mentioning God a lot. That really bothered me. I was an atheist when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I hated God. I hated you. If you liked God, I hated you. If you talked about God, I hated you. If they talked about God in AA meetings, I would get up in the middle of meetings and leave. You know, I could not handle that. Here's what I liked about AA. There was this guy named, I can't even think of his name, but he was an old retired Navy guy. And he used to wear these big country overalls, and he was just like a grandfather type, really peaceful. And he would always come up to me every day. I used to go to the Al-Anon Club. It was a noontime meeting, right, which is just a great show. If you go to a noontime meeting in AA, it's the best show on earth, right? And so he would always come up to me, and he'd put his hand on my shoulder, really lightly. And when he first did it, it was like I got real tense, because I come from a world where you just don't touch men. Right? Don't touch me. Don't say anything to me. Don't give me anything. I'm way too, you know, shut down. But for some reason, I liked it when he put his hand on my shoulder. It felt like I was safe, right? And I used to actually look forward. I'd ride the bus to the meeting and look forward to seeing him, you know? Because he'd always come up to me and look me in the eye and put his hand on my shoulder and say, good to see you. Make sure you come back tomorrow. And I used to say, yeah, I'll be back tomorrow. But the truth is, I had to come back. I had to get my sheet signed. So, you know, I didn't have really a choice. But I started to like AA. What I didn't do, you guys don't have here, but they used to put the 12 steps on the wall, right? Well, I think that's a problem, first off, because it's not good for a guy like me who's been a thief his whole life, because they have that nice step, which is make amends. I know what that means. Make amends means pay back the money. I ain't doing that. And so, and then they have all these different things with God intermixed there, man. Forget about it, right? And so I wasn't going to do that. And in my group, and I think this is a, I don't know if this is a problem with AA. I don't think there's any problem with AA. I think it is what it is, but... In my meeting, there's like 50 people, and you had it was basically there was a group of people that were like hardcore AA big book thumpers, right? And some of them didn't even look happy. They were like, go a 4-step, you know, and they were like, and I'm like, wait, she's way too serious about this sobriety stuff. And then there was a group of people who were all like in the flop and you know, love and peace and God. And I was like, man, forget about that. That's way too flaky for me. And then there was a group who were just like, you know what? You just don't drink and you go to meetings. You just don't drink. And they always invite me to go out. We're going to go play pool. You want to go play pool? So I'd go out and play pool with these guys. And they were like some of my drinking buddies, man. They were like raunchy, man. And I'm like, oh, these are cool guys. This is cool. But what I found out through a relapse is that may be good for them. But that is not good for a guy like me. I'm a real alcoholic. I need a real solution. I didn't middle of the road by using. I was not a middle of the road kind of guy, right? I robbed banks on bond, okay? Come on, let's get real here. I wasn't a half measured in my drinking and using things. That was not who I was. And so why would I think my recovery can also be half measured? I'll do middle of the road. I'll just pick and choose what I want to do. Don't work for me. Now, I'm real comfortable in what people do in Alcoholics Anonymous is their business, okay? I don't care. None of my business. I made a third step decision back in 1993 through my will and my life over the care of God, which means I no longer am God. That means whatever you do in Alcoholics Anonymous is your business. Also means whatever I do is my business. All right? So what I do is I do the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't do that my first year. I ended up drinking after a year sober. And then 3 months I drank and drug in AA, working at a rehab. I worked at a rehab and drank. You know, I was the type of guy, this is how sick I am. I'm working at this rehab, and I'm in the middle of a relapse. I'm not telling anybody. I go to the big book meeting in the morning, a step meeting group in the afternoon. I go to the noontime meeting with everybody. I go to the 6 o'clock meeting, and then I jet off to my buddy's house, and I drink all night and smoke crack all night. This is now post-crack. And all of a sudden, I sneak back onto the ranch. Sometimes I'd be in my trailer, and I would be really drunk and really high, and guys would come and they'd go... And I'm like, what? And I open the window, there'd be some new guy who just came in like 2 weeks, and he's trying to go to rehab, and he's like, man, I really need to talk to you. I'm like, what do you get in here? And I said, what do you want to talk about? He said, man, I want to leave. I want to go home. I want to get out of here. I'm like, man, don't go. This is the best thing, man. You want to be sober. And I would talk about 100 miles an hour to convince this guy to stay in sobriety. And he'd say, man, I really appreciate that. And then he would leave, and I'd go back and drink some more and smoke some more. That's how sick I was. And so when I got sober on March 6th, 1993, I'd given up. I'd been drinking and drugging. I'd been waking up for 3 months thinking, okay, I'm not drinking today. I'm done drinking. And I would get up. And I would, all of a sudden, by 6 o'clock, the thought would pop in. Or not even a thought, I would just be drinking, you know. And it was just like, man, I gave up. And the thought went through my mind that whole week, from March 1st to March 6th, the thought that went through my mind was, you know what, what's the use? You gotta just kill yourself. Which kind of frightened me. And the other thought, which was even more scarier, was, you know what, Brian? You could go to Phoenix, and you could rob about 3 banks in a week. Mm-hmm. Bankroll yourself, go to Vegas, and be a poker player. And I, you know, and when I get a thought like that, I'm like, I start to think, yes, and then I will definitely, and, you know, all of a sudden, I'm like the kingpin in Vegas, and if you ever watch me play poker, it wouldn't have been good. Right? And on March 6th, I got 12-step back into AA. By a guy, a good friend of mine, a guy who I was running with in AA, who, and I say this because sometimes we get running partners in early sobriety, and I know this because I've seen this happen, is we get really close to someone and then we see him start to slip up, but we're so close to him, we're such good buddies, that we don't want to say anything to him, we don't want to make him mad, or we don't want to piss him off, so we kind of let him do, and all of a sudden, they're gone. And what happened is Max made my drinking his business. He called me on it. He risked our friendship, right? And I was mad. I started to defend it. I started to get up to leave because he asked me how long I've been sober. And he got in my face. He got really close to me, and he wasn't a confrontational kind of guy. He was one of those heroin addict kind of mellow guys, you know, California, long hair, you know, hey, dude, it's too little dope. And he said to me, he got really in my face. He spent a lot of time in California State Penitentiary, so he had a little edge to him. And he got really close to me, and he said, you know what? Cut it. He says, the truth is, dude, I love you too much to watch you die in front of me, man. How long you been sober? And at that moment, this is one of those turns where I could have gone right one more time, and I've been making right. I could have done that easy. I could have said, screw you, Max, and I could have got in I could have got into a vehicle, although it would have been stealing, but I would have done it, and then left the right, right? But I didn't do that. For some reason, all the fight left me. It was like, I just started crying in front of this guy, and this guy was like, there was only a guy I cried in front of, and I hadn't cried in a long time. I hadn't cried in years, but I couldn't stop. I was a broken man at that moment. I just said, man, I need help. I can't stop drinking, dude. And he said, well, and he gave me a big hug. And he said, you'll be all right. You'll be all right. He said, I'll sit with you. I said, if you leave me, I am gone. He says, I'm not leaving you, man. And I went to bed that night. He slept on the foot of the, you know, like on the floor, you know, near the door. And Max saved my life, man, because I'm the type of guy, you know, like, you know, I would have left. And when I run, I'm a jackrabbit, man. I run, and I do anything to survive. I will hustle, I will rob, I will do things, and I don't care about the consequence. And that moment, I just surrendered, and he sat with me that whole night. And the guy who owned that rehab came and saw me the next day, and I thought he was going to kick me to the streets, and he didn't kick me to the streets. He said, you know, he said what everybody was saying at that time, which is, man, I love you too much to watch you die, so you don't have to leave, because you can't work here. She can't leave. And I said, well, I don't have the money. It was $6,000 a month. This was a high-end rehab. I said, man, I don't get that kind of money. He says, I don't want your money. He says, you can stay here as long as you need to stay here. I just want to see you get better. And I became a patient at the place I worked at. And it was very humbling. And the woman that I'm married to, she was in rehab with me. And she'll tell you this story because the next day I got a sponsor, a guy named Kim, who has become my sponsor, who was real direct with me. I'll tell you about him in a minute. But on Monday, I had to go in front of a circle, there's 50 patients, and I had to go in front of the circle and get honest about what I was doing. I had to finally say, you know what, I've been living a lie for 3 months, you know. And I was sitting up there, and I was pacing, and I wanted to jump out of my skin so bad, man. I was so uncomfortable. And Chloe, who's my wife, and two other girls, this girl Zoe and this other girl, I can't remember her name, but they literally held me there because I wanted to just run. And they just kept saying, you know what, you just do this, you're going to be all right, man. You just got to go through this. And I sat in that circle and I got honest and I got nailed by people. They were pissed. Especially guys I had talked out of getting high while I was getting high. They were not happy with that. Are you kidding me? I knew you were, you know, I could see you crushing your teeth, man. And so, I got this sponsor, and this is what I hate about my story. There's so many things I want to tell you, and now I've got like 10, 15 minutes to tell you about how wonderful recovery is. But I'm going to be real honest about you. My life has changed dramatically. And I'm not even going to get into the technical. Just know this. The sponsor I had told me one thing. It was real clear. He said, Brian, just don't kid yourself. You were never in AA. You just need to know that. And I was pissed about that. I'm like, yeah, I was in AA. You saw me go to that meeting. He said, no, you were in a fellowship of people who don't drink. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous is the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Without the 12 steps, that is not the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. That is nothing. That is just hanging out with people who don't drink. He says, this is a bigger deal. It just is not about drink. Drinking is not your problem. Drinking is your solution, always has been your solution. Your problem is you have alcoholism. See, I always thought I got a drinking problem, so I just won't drink. I should be okay. I mean, because if you have a drinking problem and you stop drinking, that's it. I mean, that's the solution for a drinking problem. You just don't drink. But I have alcoholism. And for me, it's as simple as this. If I got pneumonia, and one of my symptoms is a cough, and I go to the doctor and all he does is treat my cough, I still got pneumonia. Two things are going to happen. Either my cough is going to return or I'm going to die of pneumonia. Well, I have alcoholism, And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and the symptom is I drink too much. I put alcohol in my system, and something physically happens to me that makes me want to drink more. Alright? And so I removed that symptom, but I still had alcoholism. Meaning, everything about me has not changed. A spiritual awakening, the 12th step of Alcoholics Anonymous says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, and they even tell you what the result's going to be. They tell you right there. You take these steps, you will have a spiritual awakening. Now, if you're an atheist like me, that scares the hell out of you, right? Like, ooh, I don't know if I want that. But he was real clear, put it in the lamest term. He said, spiritual awakening, you have a whole new attitude now look upon life. A whole new way of thinking. And if you have a whole new way of thinking, your actions will be different. Because every action you take is preceded by a thought. And I was like, whoa, this guy's like, he's like the Dalai Lama. He's deep. And he was just some country cowboy from New Mexico, right? Drove a big truck and he welded for a living, but he was very peaceful. And he told me that the solution is spiritual. And he says, and I know you've got a problem with that. He says, but you don't have to have a problem with that. Let's go through the 12 steps. And whatever's going to happen with your relationship with the God of your understanding will happen. It'll be the way it's supposed to be. And you don't have to define it. You don't have to figure it out. Let's just start with the first step. And I started to go through the steps. And I go through the book. And I go chapter at a time. And the reality was I did not know I was alcoholic. I did not know that my reaction to alcohol is completely abnormal. I didn't know that. An allergic reaction means an abnormal reaction to the substance. Right? I didn't know that. I didn't understand that when I went to the store, when I was in the liquor store, I went to the bar to have a few drinks when I was on parole. I was just going to have a few drinks, and then I would change my mind during the second drink. I always thought I was changing my mind. I thought I was making that decision. That's the lie that my ego tells me, that I'm just making a different decision here. Like, yeah, I know in the parking lot 10 minutes ago or 15 minutes ago, you just want to have two or three. But now I'm changing my mind, and we're going to stay here all night and get drunk. Well, I had no control over that. Once I put it in my system, and you know what that did for me? Is this resentment I had against my mom, this hatred about her weakness, immediately went away. The moment I accepted my own alcoholism, that physically I'm different, my dad always used to tell me, why don't you drink like me? And his drinking was one drink, maybe two, and that was it. Get some willpower. Well, I'm different than my dad. It's not because he's stronger than me, he has better resolve, he's morally better than me. It's we're physically different. I got a problem. Something, I'm lacking something physically, and I put alcohol, it doesn't matter, I put it in my system, all bets are off. And when I got that, I understood alcoholism. I got that piece. And then the flip side is, okay, so what? What about the mind? That's the real problem, which is when the thought comes into my mind, I drink. So if I don't have any protection. And the funny thing is, if you read page 84 in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it's the best promise. The 10-step promises blow away every promise in the book as far as I'm concerned. Because that's what I got hooked on. It says, when the thought occurs, I will recoil as if from a hot flame. I never recoiled from alcohol. When the thought occurred to me, I would plot and plan and try to figure out how to get out of the system I'm in. Either I'm in prison, I would make wine. I made wine and said, you know, come on. I mean, I would drink anything that would get me drunk, you know, anything. And it was nasty. Anyone who's made a drink in prison, it is nasty. But I don't care, because once I get one down, I'm okay. I'm all right, you know. Well, something's got to replace. Something's got to go in my mind. I remember when I read those promises, I remember going to my sponsor and saying, you tell me that if I go through these steps, when I get to the 10th step, that's going to happen? He said, yeah, man, that's what's happened. When the thought occurs, you will recoil as if from a hot flame. Because if it's anything else, I'm done. If it's anything like, and not to be disrespectful, the triggers and relapses and all that other stuff, but if that's what I got to figure out, what's my trigger, what's my relapse, you know, forget about it. I've been through all the rehabs in the world. Psych counseling, caseworkers, I've done it all, man. That don't work for me. You know what works for me? God works for me, right? The God of my understanding. And the fact I even say that today, I still sometimes get like, who said that? You know, like, where did that come from? You know? Because the reality is I was atheist when I came in, and I'm a spiritual man today. I live by spiritual principles. And I don't know what that means to anyone else, but I tell you what it means to me. It means for 15 and a half years I haven't had any drink or drugs in my system. It means for 15 and a half years I've been a man of integrity, right? And it means for 15 and a half years I haven't hurt the people I used to hurt. the mom and dad, when I got sentenced in front of Judge Bilby back in 1984, when they gave me my sentence, when Judge Bilby looked down at me and said, "Oh, man, what we got here is a one-man crime wave." You know, he thought that was funny, right? And I'm like, "Yeah, I'm a one-man crime wave. You know, I'm a gangster. You know, $50 thug here, you know. 50 cent ain't nothing, man. $50 here." And I walked out of the courtroom that day, and my family was crying. My mom was crying. My grandmother was crying. You know, my aunts were crying. Everybody was crying because I was going off to prison. And all I thought was, why are they crying? I'm going to prison. It's like somehow I'm so consumed with self that I don't see that my actions destroy everybody around me. The biggest lie any alcoholic ever says is, "Why don't you get off my back, leave me alone, because I'm only hurting myself." But guess who I took to prison with me? I took my mom to prison, took my dad to prison, my brothers, my nephews. They all went to prison with me. You know, I never said that when I was doing time. It was just, "Where's my money order?" You know, "Where's my money? My money order today?" Call her up, you know, collect. "Hey man, I didn't get my money order. Send me my money order." You know, that's how selfish I am, right? The reality is, I take my people with me. You know what? My mom disowned me. Right? The last time I went to prison, she wrote me a letter saying, "You can't come home anymore." That's not the case today. Through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was able to go back to my mom. You know, I did a first step. I started looking at the second step, right? I came to believe that maybe there's something out there. I made this decision to turn my will and my life over to that. And then I wrote this fourth step that you gotta write. If you want recovery, you gotta do it, right? So I wrote that. And I'm a four column kind of guy. You know, I do it the way it's laid out in the big book. I did a fear inventory, sex inventory. Went and shared it with this guy. When I got to my ninth step, right? I went and sat down in front of my mom, and what I realized was the destruction of the man I used to be. Who I was just like, when I looked at who I used to be, I'm like, man, what kind of son is that? You know? What kind of brother is that? You know? Alcoholism just rips me from everybody I love. And it was the best moment of my recovery. The best moment was probably the most painful moment, and I was sitting in front of my mom, just me and her, nobody else, my dad, just me and her. And I just got real. I just laid it online. I said, "Mom, you know what? You know," in the words, it wasn't so much the words as it was what was in my heart. It's like, "I can't believe that I made you write that letter. I can't believe that I made you disown me." And that's not how I went into recovery. I went into recovery thinking, "My mom disowned me. How dare her?" I came out of the steps knowing that I made my mom do that. I forced her to write her baby. And I can tell you right now, I had a lot of emotion around that. We cried for a long time. But I can tell you right now, you know what the reality was? I didn't even really feel the magnitude until years later my daughter was born. And she was about 3 months old. And I remember I came out of the shower and she was laying on the bed. And I just sat there and looked at her. And I realized, like, I will love this child no matter what she does. It doesn't matter what she does. I will always love her. And I had this overwhelming feeling of unconditional love. And I never had that before. I've never felt unconditional love. My love always had conditions. And at that moment, I knew what it meant to love a child. And I remember, man, calling my mom up and saying, "You know, I know I said this to you before, and I know I've changed and everything, but I just got to tell you one more time, I'm so sorry that I put you through that." And my son, the same way. You know, I look at those kids, and I realize, man, what a son I've become. And so I live this way. I can't even tell you. If you get nothing out of what I say, just know this. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. It saved my life. And I'm not a guy who lives in AA. I'm not a guy who hides out in Alcoholics Anonymous. I go out and live life, man. You know, I do it all. I'm a firm believer that the principles that I've learned through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous allow me to do lots of things that I shouldn't even do. Alright? And so, I could speak for 2 more hours, but I'm gonna close out of respect and probably gotta drive an hour and a half. But I'll close with this. You know, there's some men in this room that mean more to me than lots of people. And so one thing that my sponsor taught me and that I share with guys is you know, the real deal here is for us to be of maximum service to God. That's the whole deal. The deal is not about me anymore. It's not about me getting my life together and getting healed, and that's beyond that. It's about me being of service to God's kids. Because that's the truth. There's people right in this room, right here, who are dying of untreated alcoholism, who are destined to drink and maybe die. And it's our job is to find them and get out of ourselves, our little cliques, you know, like, you know, how it is to meet and everybody gets cliquey and they go there. Forget about that. If you really want to do God's work, step back and look at the guy sitting in the corner who's all by himself, who's lonely, who maybe doesn't have anybody, and go reach out to him or reach out to her and say, hey, let's go have some coffee. Because that's what people did for me, right? And so I make that my life. You know, I do lots of work at the prison system. I do more meetings inside the prison than I do outside the prison, right? And I do that because there's not a lot of people going in, right? And so I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love you guys, and I appreciate Dickie asking me.